people who were in slip trenches did not survive, whereas we in these open dam bomb craters that were, oh, they were, you felt so naked and exposed, we survived. Eventually, A Company came through. I remember Stu Chambers, platoon came through, us, and we got into the actual fortifications of the Pas de Calais, and we had some respite and rest there after a waterless day or so on. We had something to eat and drink. We also found a lot of really whacked out enemy who had been subjected to heavy fire and bombardment. And one incident I recall, as we took several prisoners there, was finding a German Kriegsmarine chap who spoke very good English. And I asked him what in the world he was doing in German uniform. Oh, he said, I went home to visit my mother. He said, I'm from Chicago originally. He said, there I was. And he said, I was conscripted into the German Navy. And he said, here I am, a Marine. Well, suffice it to say that these people were under control, and our people were much relieved, and I can't remember his name, and I don't have any records, but we had in our company a big Indian from Eastern Ontario, but we used to call him the Chief, and he got into some aquavit, I think, and he got very, very drunk, very loaded. So we're in this bunker, and someone told me that the Chief was out of control, and I better do something. He picked up a German Luger and he was going to do somebody some harm. So I said, well, okay, I'll do what I see. I'll look into this. I went to see the Chief, with whom I had a pretty good rapport, and tried to talk him out of the Luger. And he said, all right, Frank, that's enough. If you take one more step toward me, you're gonna get it. Ah, Chief, I said, you're having me. He said, you wouldn't do that to me. We're two good friends. And as I'm moving, inching toward him, that damn 9mm thing got bigger and bigger and bigger. And in his state, he quite easily could have pulled the trigger, but I could sneak a look. I saw that the safety was on, so I was able to disarm him, and he was taken away. There was no thought of any charge against the Chief, because tragically, I believe he was killed shortly after that in the next action. Well, so much for the Pas de Calais. We had several hundred prisoners that we had to get out of there, and the way we got out of it ourselves and back to our own area along the beach, which was now secure, was to march the prisoners ahead of us through the minefields. And they knew the way through the minefields, and obviously we made it. So, once again, we're going up the Channel Coast at a pretty good lick, and we're again on transport and trucks. We bypass Dunkirk, and we get up towards the Scheldt, and we get up to the action of the Leopold Canal. And nothing of any incident happened to me in my experience or my platoon. The only thing that I can say is, in the retreat, as we're advancing so rapidly, there was still German resistance, lots of snipers about, and the enemy obviously had a great advantage in as much as he had every feature, every range taped at his disposal, so at times his fire was pretty devastating and pretty accurate. At the crossing of the Leopold Canal, I failed to mention it in my company commander at this time, I mentioned Armando Gray, who was a sergeant. Shorty, whose name I can't remember, was invalided out or sent back for rest. Armando Gray was a platoon sergeant. The company was commanded by Roger Sheldrum. Des Crofton had been wounded and was back in England in hospital. I came out ill at the crossing, just before the crossing of the Leopold Canal, was sent back to 12 General Hospital in Bruges, and came out of Ostend on the first hospital ship out of Ostend, back to England. Among those who came out at the same time was Colonel Matthews, the CO of the Regina Rifles, with whom we were brigaded. We landed in Southampton and through a casualty clearing hospital in Southampton. And the only amusing thing that happened there was a young French-Canadian officer who took exception to the strict and stern discipline of the English nurses and said, as he got his daily shot of life-saving penicillin in the arse, "What do you think I am, a goddamn dartboard?" In any case, from this casualty clearing hospital in Southampton, it wasn't Southampton. We landed at Southampton. The hospital was in Basingstoke. I was sent out to East Anglia to the Roman Way Convalescent Hospital in Colchester. And that was probably one of the best periods of my service overseas, inasmuch as sick parade was Monday mornings for the walking wounded, which I was, and you could get a pass on Tuesday, and London was close by, and off you were to London until the next Monday. Historically, Colchester is a very, very interesting city. I found it so at that time because it is part of the early Roman conquest of the British Isles, and many Roman works and mounds were evident at that time. I can't say I enjoyed my time in Colchester. However, it also was of interest from another point of view. It was on Buzzbomb Alley. The V1s would come up the Thames Estuary right over us. And, none of them landed around us. But London took quite a pasting and was badly devastated from the result of the V1s and subsequently from the V2s. Okay, so these are the V2s that were coming up Buzzbomb Alley up the Thames Estuary, being pursued again by Typhoon fighters and I suppose other aircraft. Many of them were shot down in flight. As I'm sure you've heard, the V2 was fine as long as its motor was running, but when the motor stopped, look out, you waited for the bang then. From Roman Way Convalescent Hospital, I guess I went back into the reinforcement stream, but I do recall I had some leave. I had a couple of interesting experiences. I had a leave course at Oxford University on current events. It was open to all ranks of the Allied forces, and the course I attended was at Balliol College. And we had everything from private soldiers to brigadiers of British, American, and Canadian forces there. I'll never forget the first night in the dining hall when the prefects in the above the salt at the raised end of the dais of the great dining hall laid down the rules had a few remarks to make, and they, as I recall, said something like this. Gentlemen, just a few of the rules of the dining procedure, and they rhymed off the light and the mulled ales and so forth, the light beers and the mulled ales that were available. No wines, of course, but just beer and ale and mulled ale and cider that were available with the meals. Would you please, although you may admire the mugs that the ale served in, and you note the several generations of the same family that have attended this university, please don't take them as souvenirs. And if you happen to be seated next to an American, just leave him alone. He'll manage to cut his meat and eat his meal without your assistance. So that was one of the things I remember. And another, look at the contrail of that jet up there, isn't it? Way up, can you see it?
Yep.
Now that was multiplied 1,000-fold during the D-2 and D-1, when all those aircraft were flying. In any case, another experience was in a day trip. We went to two places. We went and had tea with Lady Tweedsmuir, the Canadians on the course, and I had, in my ignorance, not appreciated the fact that her husband, John Buchan, was an author of such wide scope. I knew him as a novelist, but apparently he was an engineer, and in his library there was just volume after volume of technical tomes that he had written, as well as his well-known novels. So it was delightful to be in the presence of Lady Tweedsmuir, who recalled their visit when he was Governor General of Canada, their visit to Victoria, and remembered Victoria fondly. Another highlight of that short leave course was a visit to Stratford and seeing all the usual touristy things there. And I recall having purchased from the verger at the church where supposedly Shakespeare was buried a rubbing of the headstone on Shakespeare's grave, and I forget exactly how it goes. Blessed be he or something, and cursed be he who disturbs these bones, written in early English. And for years and years and years, that rubbing lay in the bottom of a trunk. And I thought, what a shame that, you know, here it is, signed, dated, and so on by the verger, that should be there. So one day, I had a chat with my friend Sam Lane of Old English Inn Fable in Anne Hathaway's cottage here in Victoria. Squadron leader Samuel Lane, RAF retired, said, why, of course, Frank, I'd love to have that. So I was very pleased to give this rubbing to Sam. On a subsequent occasion, when I visited the Old English Inn, Anne Hathaway Cottage, I saw it. It's mounted there today. So much better it be there than somewhere in the trunk of mine. So here we are on this leave course, and the other thing that occurred to me was I went to a social evening and a dance at Rhodes House in Oxford. And while there, I had a very, very, I had new kit. I had a new kilt that I'd purchased at Gives in London. Also, a very highly prized new trench coat, in which was my travel worn. Someone else admired my trench coat, and it disappeared out of the cloakroom at this social evening at Rhodes House. So here I was with no travel warrant, little else other than the uniform I stood in. But I had met a very charming lady who was serving with the 8th Air Force, who was a countess from way back. In any case, she took compassion on me and took me to her home. I met her mother, and I was able, with the, I forget what they call the people that looked after traveling troops, I was able to get a travel warrant back to Roman Way Convalescent Hospital. Shocking that I cannot remember her name, but we had, we met again in London, and while there on leave, not finding, readily finding accommodation, she found me a very comfortable apartment that was the apartment of a member of Parliament from Cumberland. It was rather interesting. From the bedroom window of this apartment, you could look out in the moonlight at the Tower of Westminster, at least the tower which contains the bell, Big Ben. The clock is not Big Ben, the bell is Big Ben. So these are just little personal things that happened.
What was life like in London during the war and in England in general?
In London, England, the people of London were magnificent. They rallied together. They were like one big community. They were like people, I would imagine, people who found themselves together on the ocean in a lifeboat. They were one for, everyone was helpful and cheerful. They put up with shortages, hardships, and made the best of a very difficult time.
And where did you go from there? How long were you in London?
I went back to the continent from convalescent leave in hospital. I went back with the Canadian, with the occupation forces. I was first posted to Sangvorden, which is just outside of Wilhelmshaven, to the occupation battalion of the regiment. And while at Sangvorden, which was the telecommunications center for the German Navy worldwide, didn't do a great deal there. My good lifelong friend Graham McCall, now deceased, was at Sangvorden, same time I was. I was supernumerary. So eventually I was posted to the, in the 30 Corps area as a garrison engineer officer with three Canadian work section. There were, we were commanded by an engineer major, there were two engineer captains, three lieutenants, and three non-engineering captains. I had about 10 NCOs and 2,000 German troops. And we were concerned with constructing leave centers for the British occupation forces under command of 30 Corps Field Marshal Montgomery. And we were stationed in Osnabrück, Germany. As well as constructing leave centers, we were demolishing POW facilities, and the best way to describe the demolition was there was nothing that could be done with them. They were so lice infected that most of them were burned. They had been slave labor camps, mainly Poles and Russians, during the hostilities. I still have a few souvenirs from Osnabrück, from the Klocknerwerken, and that was that experience. From there, I went on leave to England. Excuse me. Overstayed my leave, missed my draft back to Canada.
How did that happen?
Oh, I guess I got partying in London. In any case, I got a flight back with some friends who had a DC-3 that they were Victoria Air Force people who were doing reconnaissance for usable airfields that they could fly occupation forces back on leave. They had their own transport with them. They'd liberated a jeep. I recall we ended up at a German, the old German city of Celle, C-E-L-L-E. And the next morning I was flown by a young RAF pilot in a two-seater German training plane called the Buca, a low-wing monoplane, back to an airfield badly bomb-pitted near Osnabrück. And that's when I found out that my draft call had come and I'd missed it. In any case, I eventually made a draft. And strangely enough, through the Pas-de-Calais area, which was quite different than... would you stop it for a moment, please? Through the Pas-de-Calais area, which, unlike other parts of the country that I traveled through, mainly Holland and Belgium, which were fairly quickly rehabilitating themselves, the Pas-de-Calais was still showing the ravages of war. They had not done the reconstruction work that other countries seemed to have done. From there, back to England, and eventually from Southampton, or at least to a holding area in southern England somewhere, onto a troop ship, and I came home on one of the last voyages of the Ile de France. And she was a very, very heavily laden. This was in the spring of... what year would it be? In the spring, late fall or early spring of 1946, the spring of 46, she was banged about quite a bit by the North Atlantic storms, and we were 48 hours late getting into Halifax because of the storm, and I felt badly for those troops that were down in the forepeak of the ship on the very lowest deck, because it was impossible to live there. Most individuals were violently ill. The people down in that forepeak, I'm sure that the arc of the up and down motion of the bow was at least through 40 or 50 feet every time she'd go through a wave. I am not subject to mal de mer, so there were only two meals a day, morning and evening, four sittings at each meal, 10,000 troops aboard the ship, and I'm sure I put on 30 pounds on the homeward voyage, so I ate at every one of the four meals, morning and night, and didn't suffer any of the consequences. We got on the troop train in Halifax, bound for Vancouver, and again, eat. It was nothing to have half a dozen eggs for breakfast. Who'd seen a fresh egg for years? Those powdered eggs were terrible. The train crew, the dining car steward, treated us very well. And I rode a great deal of the way across Canada we didn't have an observation car then. They just had a caboose. But it was quite interesting to be back in the caboose at the end of a troop train, and great to be back in Canadian soil. So all in all, while my effort was not conspicuous by any particular activity, I'm pleased that I had an opportunity to be associated with my regiment, and to have survived some of the action. It's a wonderful thing that the human mind can forget all of the horrors. And I have no nightmares, no regrets, I'm just very, very thankful that I've had this experience.